Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Change the Why podcast, hosted by Pedro Gonçalves and Daryl Jace. Hey, Daryl, how you doing?
Doing all right. Chilling.
Nice. I'm super excited. We got Elliot Rowe today. He's waiting. So let's just add him and explain to the guys who this man is.
Sounds good.
Okay. So let's see what he got. Calling.
Hello.
Hey, man.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Very good. Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
Nice. Man, I've been waiting the whole week for this. Talk to you. I would say we just start out just saying who you are. Or like maybe you could explain who you are and what you do. And
Now?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay, so I'm Elliot Rowe. I'm a mindset coach for athletes, including poker players. And the vast majority of people I work with right now are poker players. And what I do is I'm a hypnotherapist, and I help people understand the root causes behind any emotional issues at the table and then resolve them. So I work with players with issues such as tilting, lack of motivation, emotional issues within the hands if they have issues being three bet, or issues calling on the river when they know they should be folding. And through the sessions, we start to go through those issues and remove the reasons behind them so that the player can then play with a much more rational mindset.
Okay, nice. Do you you work with fighters, right? UFC fighters?
Yeah, I also work with UFC fighters, including a few champions. In terms of the work I do with the fighters, it ends up being relatively similar to the work I do in poker in terms of things like anxiety and self-sabotage come up. And again, we sort of work through those issues so that they can perform at their best in the cage.
You also work with other type of people, like fighters and poker players? For me, for example, seem like very... well, not like close to each other, because the one thing is very mental, the other thing is very
physics. I mean, ironically, they're very, very close in terms of both of them. You're putting a lot on the line. So in poker, obviously, you've got all of the emotions amplified because you've got your money on the table. And obviously for the fighters, they're getting in the cage and fighting with somebody, which is an incredibly high stress and high risk activity. And again, they're fighting for money. Typically, they'll get paid double if they win. So there's an awful lot on the line. So in both activities, there's a similar sort of pressure and the similar chance of self-sabotage or fear of failure and anxiety and things. So although they're very different activities, the mental side and the amplification of stress is actually quite similar between the two.
Isn't the... the first thing I think about fighters, isn't like the time where they have to think about something very, very short? You know, like a... like playing a heads-up hyper-turbo tournament in poker, for example? Because they, the fights don't last very long, do they?
Yeah, split-second decisions. But again, it's a bit like a poker player looking to be in the zone or playing their A game. For athletes, whether it's fighters or any other athlete, they just want to be in the sort of the natural flow, the natural zone, where they don't have anything holding them back. They're not second-guessing themselves in the cage. So it's a similar sort of state they're trying to reach. The other thing with the fighting is, although the fight may be a maximum of 15, 25 minutes long if it's a championship fight, the weeks and weeks of training beforehand and the amount of emotional stress that comes up knowing that you're going to be fighting someone who is very well trained in front of potentially millions of people is another part where the stress management comes in. You know, I'll be working with people who previously, you know, won't have slept the week before the fight, and we'll be working together and they'll be able to sleep through those nights. Things like that. So it's not just their performance in the cage, it's also reducing the stress levels leading up to the fight for them.
You were talking about flow states, and is it hard? In my opinion, it just seems way harder to get in the flow state in poker than it is with any other profession. I was wondering what your thoughts on that were.
I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, everyone in every sport complains about it to me. So, you know, I'm sure the fighters would probably say, you know, but everyone performs better in the gym than they do in the cage. You know, golfers, you know, say that it's the most mental of all games. I think it's something where when you're an expert and you're playing in that and you're taking it to a very high level, it always seems like the hardest thing to do if it's your activity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so, I was just thinking because poker's like one of the few things where it's like, okay, I make a decision, I click fold, and then I wait another minute or so, then I click fold, and I wait another minute.
Oh, yeah, so, I mean, I guess one tabling, yeah. But I guess it depends which games you're playing. If you're sort of, for the guys who are really multi-tabling and they don't have long between decisions, it's definitely something, you know, it's click, 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 click. Do you know what I mean? So I guess perhaps the difference there in comparison with perhaps live poker, which obviously there's a long time between decisions, it could be harder. I mean, for the live poker, though, what I spend a lot of time with people doing is trying to make extra games within the game so they can stay in the correct mindset. So that might be putting people on ranges, even when they're not in the hand, looking at different body language tells throughout the entire session, taking notes, just making sure that even though there are going to be these periods where your mind wouldn't necessarily be active, they're staying within the game rather than sitting on their iPad or reading a book.
That's pretty interesting. I don't know. I was kind of thinking about, like, it's kind of interesting because I feel like in live MTTs especially, because they're so long and so multi-day, like, early on, like, you should just really, like, try and relax and, like, control your energy. Like, I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
I think it's something where if it's in a multi-day tournament, it's obviously different to a one-day tournament. There's some argument for conserving energy, but then I would sort of say you would still be better off doing something like, you know, instead of perhaps picking every player to put a range on, picking the possibly your biggest threat at the table and choosing to put them on ranges in hands. But certainly I think when people are sitting there reading a book or sitting watching a film on their iPad, they're giving away value. And that's even at the early stages. I don't think anyone should be sitting there watching a film when they're in, especially in the high buy-in tournaments, and people still do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned something about that I would like to ask you about that sleeping.
Yeah.
This is something that I'm pretty sure a lot of poker players also struggle with, especially when they are like 1 year or 2 years in, and they're like, you know, they are in that state of, I need to make money. At the same time, I do understand that I need to rest, but I don't want to rest too much. And then they wake up and then the games are not good, for example, let's just say as an MTT player. So do you consider yourself also like a sleep therapist? There's like a name for that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a sleep therapist, but I do work with a lot of people involving. But basically, sleep comes into a lot of the things that I'll be dealing with. So for a poker player, it wouldn't be the anxiety necessarily of the big event coming up like it is for the fighters.
Exactly,
but a lot
yeah.
of the time, it's more they've played a hand poorly that day or in a tournament, and they just can't get it out of their mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're ending up lying in bed, thinking over this hand, thinking of it. So, you know, the things we would be working on with poker players is more around letting go of those hands, marking them, knowing that you're going to be studying it tomorrow, and that there's just no point in wasting time that evening, you know, staying awake. Or the other thing is creating rational schedules for poker players so that, you know, they're not staying up till 5 in the morning one night and then, you know, the next day getting up at 9 a.m. still. You know, basically we want to create a rational, sustainable schedule. It's a bit harder with MTT players, obviously, because chances are if you've had a successful night, you've had a very late night. But it's still something where we can put rest days into the week so that you know that you're what you're working towards, and you also know sort of that you're earning those days off by putting the work in. So it becomes more like a job. I mean, some people complain that it removes some of the idea of being absolutely free as a poker player.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, having the set time off frees them from feeling guilty about not playing poker when they are having time off. So, you know, a lot of guys will be like, oh yeah, you know, I'll take half a day off whenever I feel like it. But then when they take that half day off, they're thinking, oh, I could be in the tournaments, you know, this is starting now, should I be playing? Whereas if you have this fixed time off that you know there's just no poker allowed, you can actually 100% enjoy yourself on that day rather than sort of always half playing and then half relaxing. So it turns out, I think typically it turns out to be a really big positive for poker players to take that schedule on.
Yeah, that sounds a lot
like, sorry to cut you off. I think that's like an important like misconception some people might have, and maybe I'm wrong here, but it feels like a lot of people who are looking into getting hypnotherapy, they think it's just about like helping with a certain area, but it seems like you're able to help with many, many different areas. And for people who aren't having any like, you know, mental, you know, issues like depression or frustration or tilt or whatever.
It's more about just optimizing. So if there are things that you're doing at the table or in life that you can't understand why you're doing them, and that might be a lack of motivation. As I say, it might be the scheduling, not being able to sleep, playing in games that are too big, playing in games that are too small compared to your bankroll and not making the investments you should be making or could be making. All of those things, there will be a reason behind it and something that's stopping you from putting your all into things. And hypnotherapy, I mean, I should probably explain what hypnotherapy is, because sort of people haven't worked with me, they probably would have some different views. Hypnotherapy is nothing like the media portrayal of hypnosis. There's no transfer of power. I'm not clicking my fingers and telling you to do things. It's more like, it's very close to guided meditation. So the person gets very relaxed. We reach a state where you're in a sort of focused meditative state and you can start to see the root causes of issues. And then we explore those issues and try and reframe them so that they're not holding you back. And that's why it's something that can be used for almost any topic where somebody's acting irrationally or in a way that they don't feel they should be.
I think there's a lot of people who are skeptical who are like, oh, I can't be hypnotized or whatever. You know, this isn't going to work for me. Like, what would you say to those people?
I would ask them if they think they're capable of meditating. Because hypnosis is a form of meditation. And
what if they don't know? You know, like for me, for example, I had no idea. I first heard of meditation really when I talked with Daryl. That's like 9 months ago. And I mean, obviously I heard it on TV and all that. And I was like, nah, this is just magic. You know, this is not, this is not real. These guys are just faking. And then I heard it from you when you started to explain it to me. And yeah, like I'm very interested in that too. Like, what do you get to say to
So if someone just doesn't think it's possible for them, the sort of state that you're looking for in hypnosis is, as I say, meditation, or other ones that people recognize are when you wake up in the morning and you're not quite awake, but you're not quite asleep and you're just comfortable. That's the state. Or if you're driving down a motorway and you just seem to have forgotten 3 or 4 junctions and you were sort of on autopilot. So most people can recognize that they've been in those states at one point or another in their lives. And that's all it is that we're looking to do, is replicate those states. I mean, meditation, it's not something that people are really incapable of on the whole if they're taught to do it properly. It's a learned behavior. It's something that you can train yourself to get better in. The only people that really would struggle are people with incredible ADHD, who just can't sit down. If someone refuses to sit down and is moving around, then obviously it's not going to work. Virtually anyone else, if they're sitting down and they're capable of, you know, taking deep breaths and relaxing, that's the process. It's just a relatively simple process of relaxing your mind and body, and then being guided through it. Typically, hypnotherapy is a little bit easier than meditation because you have someone guiding you. Whereas
that's so true.
Meditation on your own, you know, following your breath, that can be pretty tough on your own, especially as you're getting used to it. You know, a lot of people are saying, you know, I managed to meditate for 30 seconds for a minute. With hypnotherapy, because you're being guided, it sort of gives you a shortcut to a much deeper level.
Yeah, and I found that it all comes down to this need for people in general to be guided, right? It's that when you give someone, there were like a lot of studies on this, that if you give people multiple choices, multiple options, people very often don't choose anything. So basically, if someone sits down and he doesn't know what to do, right, he will be like, oh, you know what, I'm just going to give up. But when there's this guy on Skype telling him, you know, you think now think about this and this and this, he has only one choice. He's listening to you, and you give him this one choice, this one option, and then he does what you do, right? Is this how it works?
In terms of the induction and people reaching that state, do you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, basically, people are paying to work with me. So it's very rare that somebody is actively trying to not go along with the process, actively trying to ignore me. Every now and again, I'll work with somebody who wants to be obstinate. They've got some self-sabotage issues in that way but it's very rare. And even in those cases, we can usually get to a stage where I can teach them how easy the process is, and they can get themselves to this very useful level. And most people, when they do go through the process, are actually quite impressed by it. And, you know, it's quite a fun thing to do. I mean, you know, it's certainly a different mental state. And I think most people can see the difference between just having a conversation and doing the hypnotherapy side of things. So the difference between perhaps, you know, psychotherapy or one of my hypnotherapy sessions is quite different.
Yeah. If you, how much of poker do you have to understand? This is a question I had always. You know, if you, like, were you a poker player before you got into this?
No, I wasn't. I actually ended up, I was working with some golfers, and I know someone who was involved in the poker industry, and she was telling me about tilt, and if I could help golfers, then I should be thinking about working with poker players. And then just back in 2011, I put an advert out on 2+2 saying I wanted to try working with players, and I worked with people for about 3 months for free. And worked with a lot of players in terms of designing MP3s and getting an understanding for the game, an understanding of what players needed to know and needed to be working on through the hypnosis side and the dealing with the stresses. From then, obviously, because I've been working with poker players for so long, you know, in Vegas I'll play 1-2 and things like that, but I don't play higher stakes.
Nice.
I don't play.
Are you a crusher?
I do quite well, actually.
Nice.
But I still do it relatively infrequently. Even when I was living in Vegas, it's something where I really felt my speciality, my job is basically hypnotherapy. I'm a therapist, in the same way that, you know, I do work with golfers, and I don't golf very often either. With poker, it's slightly different because I deal with some of the best players in the world, and although I don't play much, I am talking professional poker with some of the best players, you know, pretty much about 5 hours a day on average at the moment.
Oh yeah. So my
knowledge of poker from that side, you know, I have a very, very good idea of what it is people need to work on, which is obviously useful. But that was because, you know, I set it up that way, and I made sure I bought a lot of poker books, read all of them. You know, I educated myself, but as I say, I don't play. You know, I'm in America as well with the online stuff. I don't play an awful lot, but I certainly educated myself on it.
Would you play poker then, if it was allowed? Sorry, last question here.
Sorry, in terms of online?
Yeah, if it would be illegal, would you think you would go into that?
I would have an account. In Vegas, you can play, like, there's a couple of sites that are legal now, and I'd have an account and I'd play a little bit of not play money, but small stakes.
Okay.
But I'm aware of how hard poker players work to make a profit, mm-hmm. And how many hours of study a week, and the sort of work that goes in, and the level of intelligence of everybody. And I'm realistic about the fact, unless you give yourself to poker and you make it your career, you're probably going to be a losing player. And I don't see the point of putting myself in a situation where I actually know how hard people work. And, this is my full-time job. I can't do another job as well as doing this. So I like to feel I'm realistic that I can play poker for fun, and I can do pretty well because of the knowledge I've had. but it's not something where I'm looking to make a second career. I'm looking to be, you know, the top mindset coach in the industry, and that's my goal. My goal isn't to then transfer and become a professional poker player.
Yeah, that's who you are, man.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
So, like, the people who are, like, still skeptical, was there any, like, scientific studies back this up? Is this used in other fields? I think I heard it was used in, like, medicine during, like, childbirth or something.
Yeah, I mean, probably the best thing to do is if you look up hypnotherapy on Wikipedia, and then there's an awful lot of research on different studies and things where you can see that it's been used and it's been successful. Yeah, pregnant women use it. It's called hypnobirthing, which is to reduce the need for or completely remove the need for an anesthetic, because obviously not all women like to have that when they give child. They like to have them naturally. Also, anesthetics as anesthetic for people who are allergic to anesthetic. So it's actually used. Some people have had operations. Well, thousands of people have had operations under hypnosis instead of painkillers. It's also used quit smoking. It's very famous for fears and anxieties. Is where the bulk of, I would say, normal hypnotherapists are working. So fear of flying, fear of dogs, social issues with your social anxiety, things like that are where the bulk of normal hypnotherapists would be working. There aren't a lot of people in sports performance. There are some, but I'm sort of certainly, I think I'm the only person in poker at the moment who really specializes. He's a fully qualified hypnotherapist who's specializing in really providing this as a service to the community.
And what's like the difference between you exactly and like a mindset coach, say a Jared Tendler or something like that?
Okay, so I think from what I know, I mean, obviously, I haven't worked with Jared in terms of had a session with him or the other guys, but they're following sort of a slightly different concepts in terms of how to deal with the issues. So he's doing CBT mainly, sort of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is sort of very homework-based therapy where you're looking to work through the issues as you find them on the table. I'm working in it from the reverse. So instead of working on the issues from the table and then looking to resolve them, I'm looking to resolve the root cause that's causing the issues. So my sessions aren't spent so much talking about what you're doing at the table, but the emotion that you're feeling at the table and then linking that back to memories from your past. So an example I usually use is when I deal with people who have really big issues with being 3-bet and they act aggressively or irrationally when they're 3-bet at the table, an awful lot of the time we end up talking about bullying incidences in school or by the family. So we're looking to resolve the emotions around being bullied. And as we resolve those emotions in the memory and reframe them, then the person just doesn't then feel the same way at the table if someone 3-bets them. They accept it's just something to adjust to. So I'm looking to deal with the root cause rather than resolve the issue once it's already been at the table. And I would say that's probably the difference between the way I view it and some of the other mindset coaches. As I say, Jared might do some of that stuff. I haven't done sessions with him, but I know CBT is more based that way.
Yeah, it's really interesting working with, you know, intuitive type players. A lot of like where their leaks are is just biases that they have that may have to do with their past. Like a lot of guys who are kind of like timid in nature, you know, like their intuition tends to lead to like, oh, this guy is never going to fold when I do this, or, you know, this play is never going to work, or like when I call here, it's just never going to work. And then like the confident guys are always like, oh yeah, I'm like,
yeah, he's definitely going to fold.
The first guy is me, by the way, if anyone wants to know. The first guy Daryl described is me.
I think you're more of the second guy, actually.
Oh, really? No, I'm more of the guy, oh, this is never going to work. Well, this was before I worked with you. It was like...
Yeah, now you're like the latter guy. Like, oh yeah, I know exactly what he's doing here.
Yeah, absolutely. And man, this is what I learned from you. So you are the second guy and I was the first guy.
Yeah, so like, I guess getting rid of a lot of those biases and that have to do with a lot of childhood can be really beneficial for especially like intuitive players, I guess.
Well, a lot of it, everyone in some way or another is running, just running programs that they learned in childhood. So whether it's, you know, my response to things not going my way is that I should be angry, or my response to aggression is anxiety, or however you've learned to run as sort of a coping mechanism for different things, you typically just tend to then run that again. In every one of those, in every scenario. So the person who has the rage, anger tilt at the table, you know, also gets road rage, also gets really angry in a restaurant if the waiter gets his meal incorrect. And you know, we're looking to resolve the root cause of that. So as we work through and try and reprogram that sort of mindset for poker, typically they'll start to see changes in the, you know, in the restaurant when someone cuts them up in the car, and just let it go, because it doesn't need to be the program that they're running. So it's about sort of trying to accept that everyone is running these programs to some extent, and that these can be modified relatively easily.
Yeah, I remember talking with you, I had kind of just like this kind of like fear of failure and embarrassment or stuff from like a lot of like silly stuff from childhood, and like you're just pointing it out and just like, wow, this is just, you know, just really silly, you know what I mean? And it definitely helped me push past a lot of like different areas, you know, and put a lot of stuff out there.
And that's the thing, it doesn't have to be something huge or dramatic. You know, obviously sometimes it is, but there can be really what you consider sort of innocuous events that have happened in someone's childhood that can absolutely shape the way they view themselves or they live their lives. You know, the person who's called fat as a child by a teacher or by a parent can end up having a weight issue purely because they've started to label themselves that way, or the child who's called stupid, or the person who's bullied. It can really end up shaping the way you then view the rest of society and how you feel that you're viewed by the rest of society. And then when you look back at it and you realize, you know, your teacher was having a bad day and she was like a 25-year-old, you know, stand-in teacher, and that the fact that she was just stressed out by the 8-year-olds in the class doesn't mean you are stupid. It just means she was stressed. As soon as you reframe it that way, then suddenly you don't need to judge yourself in that same sense. It's something that it's quite difficult to explain to people who haven't been through this process, but it makes a lot of sense sort of as you go through it and you start to see where these things are linked together and then start to reframe them. I mean, would you guys agree? It makes it, obviously I'm trying to describe it, but it is something that sort of more needs to be experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that while you're saying it, what I'm thinking, does it help you if you, for example, know how a person got raised by their parents? You know what I mean? Like, if it was like a happy household, if it was, you know, like a lot of stress.
I mean, that's one of the things I'll always ask in the pre-session questionnaire.
Okay. Yeah.
But the things will typically come up even if I haven't been told it before, because what we're doing is we're following the subconscious back to where the root causes are. So someone describes the way they're feeling at the table as, I'm feeling under pressure, I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling frustrated and angry, I feel it in my stomach. And then I'll say something along the lines of, okay, I want you to connect that back to another connected memory, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, what's the next thing you think of? If it's all linked back to that family situation, they'll say, I'm at the kitchen table, I'm 12 years old, and my dad's shouting at my mom, and I'm really stressed. But the subconscious will lead us to where it needs to go, because it's creating that emotion at the table from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, a combination of cards doesn't automatically create an emotional response. Everyone deals with it differently. And the reason people deal with those combinations differently is because they've got different memories, different emotions to call back upon. And we're just following that chain back to where that individual has learned that behavior. And the subconscious, we usually just sort of throw it out there as we work through that process.
Yeah, that's exactly what I experienced with you. I mean, absolutely. Like, not what you just described exactly, but basically the direction that you explained. I mean, like, this is magic to me. When you mention these things like, okay, what is the next thing you think about? 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then you think about something completely different. And I'm like, after the sessions, I'm always like, where did that come from? How did he do that? You know?
And the thing is, it's not me doing anything at all. What it is your subconscious has to be getting that information from somewhere.
Yeah.
So it knows where it's coming from. It knows that the last time you had that sick feeling in your stomach, or the first time you had that sick feeling in your stomach when something was embarrassing you, it knows where it's drawing that reaction from. So, you know, all I'm doing is saying, what's the next memory? And, but you're doing all of the work. It's your subconscious who's then dragging that up, because it knows where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And that's why the process is so efficient, because rather than just saying, so where do you think your problems are coming from? And you'll be like, I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe things were stressful when I was younger. Exactly. It brings up very specific events that remind you of that same emotional response.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it's that your brain, like, basically you're the guy asking the right questions, right? In these sessions,
yeah.
And guiding basically through all these informations that you have in your brain.
Yeah, it's just a guiding. I'm guiding the individual to where they need to get to. But the process is something that is just a process. So, you know, it's not magic. I'm not forcing someone to bring up a memory. I'm not telling them which memories to bring up. I'm just saying, where did that come from? And in that very relaxed state, you'll be able to know. So you'll know where it's coming from in that state. And that's the thing, as I say, it's quite hard to describe to people, but these memories just sort of flash up in your mind, and you feel that same way you felt sometimes that when you were that child, and everything just starts to make sense as to, oh, okay, that's why I feel that way. That's why I get so angry. That's why, you know, I feel so embarrassed when somebody talks down to me or whatever it is. And it's because it's this patterned learned behavior.
Yeah. I have a lot of my students, clients, friends, they have the same reason to not start working with you. And I would like to share this to you, and would like to hear what you would tell this person as a friend. For example, if you would hear it as a third person, what would you tell your friend? And they say something like, okay, I cannot afford this right now, you know, but I will, you know, in 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, and so on. But now, for example, that I experienced what you can do and all these things that really helped me and it evolved. I mean, my game evolved immensely because of it. So what is the best thing we can do there too? Because I always have been a person, I've been telling everybody, try to do it. It's just the best thing I've ever experienced. And it will help you so much. And even if I couldn't afford it, I would do it. But obviously people are scared, you know, it's not only that idea
of their money or
it's like that hypnosis, like scared of hypnosis because they don't know it. And then it's that, oh man, I don't have that much money. I have like $300 and they're, I don't know, let's just assume, I don't know, you have the rate at $200, you know? And then it's like, wow, I have to give away 66% of my money. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, for somebody who has $300, it's an incredibly expensive service.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people tell people, you know, if you really feel it's for you, you know, make contact with me and I'll always see if I can do something to make it work, you know, with long-term payments or something like that. But the reality of it is, you know, if someone has $300 in the world, they shouldn't be giving me $200 of it. You know, I agree from that side because I wouldn't want to put someone in that financial situation. But in terms of the long-term evolving their poker game, if you have $300 because every time you make $1,000, you tilt it all off.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you go back to $1,000 again and you tilt it all off. Then you've got to start thinking, okay, is my game ever going to progress unless I stop this self-sabotage? And, you know, the work that I do is one of the ways to prevent this self-sabotage. I mean, I would also say, you know, try my MP3s, they're $25. But, you know, in reality, the vast majority of the players who work with me are playing sort of really from NL100 all the way up to the highest stakes. And the majority now are playing very, very high stakes poker or high stakes buy-in MTTs. And that is a reality of the pricing. But, you know, as I said, if people really feel...
Who are the players you work with, if you don't mind me asking? Are there any you can feel comfortable sharing, or is that...
I can only share them if they've given me testimonials. So just trying to think. Jonathan Little, Mark Herm, who just won the Full Tilt Poker leaderboard, Eric Crane, I work with Lauren Kling. I'm just trying to think of who else has given me testimonials, sorry. Gabriel Goffi, he's a PLO player who plays high stakes.
He's the Brazilian, right?
Brazilian, yeah. Verve Oasis Online. Sorry, I'm just trying to think through. It's one of those things. I work with a lot of people, and I have to think about who's already... Chris Moneymaker I've worked with.
Did you make him a winning player?
he'd won quite a lot of money before he spoke to me.
Okay.
So, but I mean, you know, if anyone wants to know the people I've been working with, there's tons and tons of reviews of my work on 2+2 from lots of well-known online names, tons and tons of Supernova Elite players. So just sort of go through and have a look at the reviews, and you'll notice names from people online. I think there's 15 pages of reviews on the 2+2 thread.
Wow, nice.
And then in terms of the UFC, I've worked with a load of fighters, but I work with two current champions, TJ Dillashaw, who's the bantamweight champion for the men's, and Carla Esparza, who's just won the strawweight championship for the women. So, you know, there's 500 fighters and 10 champions, and I work with two of those champions.
Nice. Do you think that a fighter, after working with you, let's just say he won the championship, he could be mentally prepared to play poker, vice versa, so a poker player could be prepared to be a fighter mentally?
It's just so different. No, the reality of it is someone who hasn't played poker before is going to take years for them to learn. Somebody who hasn't been professionally fighting isn't going to be able to go and win a fight. You know, it's in terms of the self-sabotage issues, could someone then put in the hours and train themselves? I think people are better prepared to sort of, once self-sabotage is reduced, people are better prepared to put in the hard work to get somewhere and to make success happen. So if you decided, right, I'm giving up poker and, you know, I want to become a professional fighter, I think without self-sabotage in the way, you're much more likely to be able to get there eventually. But, you know, obviously it's going to take years and years for both if you're fortunate enough to be clever enough to be a poker player or physically strong enough.
That's why, like, me and Pedro kind of started this, like, we kind of realized, you know, over the course of the years that the main thing that holds people back and stops them from achieving stuff is just mindset stuff, whether it be fear of failure, self-sabotage, depression, you know, whatever it is. I think that's the main thing that holds people back rather than, you know, inherent intelligence or anything like that, you know?
Well, I mean, I would say with most of the poker players I work with, they're already aware of the mistakes they make. And it's not a technical issue. You know, the one that comes up more than anything else is, I knew I was beaten on the river, but I called anyway.
Yeah.
Like, it comes up. That is just so standard. And it's like, okay, so it's impossible for you to technically improve your way out of that problem because you already know the answer. You already know that you've lost the hand. So any extra technical coaching on that particular situation can't help. The only thing that can help you resolve that issue is accepting the way to win the hand is to fold at that point. It's the only thing to do, the only option is to fold.
Yeah.
So I think that's something where, you know, a lot of poker players are far, far better than the results show, or they would be far better if they would allow themselves to do what they know how to do at the table. And this is a process of getting someone to accept that the emotions shouldn't play a part in it. If you know that you've lost the hand, you fold. And do you see where I'm coming from? It's like a
Absolutely.
Block. It's like a distinction between what someone knows technically, but then, you know, understanding that they can't, even if they become technically better, if they're still making the mistakes on purpose, then they're not going to make any more money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been playing for like 13 years, so I think I went through like a shit ton of all the mind fucks that you go through with.
You've done the whole list.
Yeah, so, like, there's so many that go behind just the hand. You know, there's the, you know, I don't want to try anymore because I'm scared to try and then lose again. Because that's just going to be, you know, just really fucking painful. I think everyone has that point. You know, you're playing 3-4 hours in a session, then you just check out and watch YouTube videos, you know?
Yeah.
And I've had that. I've had the, you know, I'm going through a downswing and every time I start ragging for the session, I'm already like, all right, I'm just going to lose today, you know? I went through the, oh, I deserve to be playing the highest stakes games right now. I'm going to be playing all these 1Ks and the toughest tournaments, even though I'm on a huge downswing. Or, you know, like I've talked to people who've been through the, you know, super conservative, even though they're super conservative with their bankroll management, even though their results are, you know, really, really good, you know? So yeah, there's so many different ways you can kind of mess yourself up. And I think a big one too was just not playing the egg game, just because I didn't, you know, I felt like I was going to lose anyways. It wasn't going to make a difference what I did. I didn't want to try and get pissed off, you know? I think Pedro was talking about this a lot. Like, focus is just one of the most important things. I don't know. Maybe you could elaborate on that, Pedro.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's, I've been talking with you actually about this a week ago, and we didn't even, I didn't even tell you what Elliot said. Actually, maybe we could do this here. Remember when we took a look at BB per 100 in early stages, late stage, mid stage, and so on?
Yeah.
And I talked with Elliot about this, and he said something very interesting. He said, so basically you focus when it matters the most, because my BB per 100 was pretty low at the beginning of the, like, of the early stages. And the more the game progressed, basically the better, the more constant it got. And like, I've been reviewing it a little bit more and got a little bit deeper into all that stuff. And what I realized is that I'm really focused when it like matters the most. And I do jumping jacks, you know, I do push-ups and sit-ups and all these things after like 5 hours in the session. And I'm pretty sure that most people are just like, you know, like you said, they're just sitting there watching YouTube videos and, you know, and I don't have anything open during that time. And I think having the 100% focus at the right time, it's just so important, especially in poker. And I guess with these UFC fighters that you talked about, Elliot, it's that they have to be focused the whole fight. And, I mean, they should be pretty happy that the fights don't last that long, right? What did you say, 15 minutes?
15 minutes for a non-title fight and 25 minutes for a championship
25
fight.
Minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Five-minute rounds. Yeah, it's brutal. It's a very tough sport.
They get hammered for 25 minutes? That's insane.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
And holding each other.
Sorry, a lot. There's a lot of wrestling as well. Yeah.
Well, but that has to be like this. When you do one mistake while you're wrestling with a guy, right? And he just breaks
you. Yeah, you lose.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, body control, right? I would assume.
Oh, the psychological pressure is just absolutely enormous with any of the fights.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously high pressure. And everything sort of milliseconds is the difference between knocking someone out cold or being knocked out cold. And, you know, it's a lot of pressure for them. But they don't have, obviously, you know, in terms of what you guys have, which is a 12-hour session. And I think it's interesting what you were saying there. The, you know, that's sort of the reverse from the norm, where you might find that on a Sunday, there are a lot of people that when they start and they've got all of those tables open, they're really focused and they're thinking about every decision in the early
Absolutely,
game.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then they're so exhausted 6 hours in that when it comes to where you actually make the money on the deep runs and where you don't, you know, don't have so many big blinds left, they're not making the right decisions. Whereas you're sort of doing the reverse. You're sort of, obviously you're focused, but not to the same level in the early game. And then as you get close to the money, you're doing all of these things that take you above what perhaps the average person on a Sunday, you know, I would say the majority of Sunday players on their breaks aren't doing jumping jacks.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? You know, you're probably in the 1% of players who's doing that, but that's being seen in your results, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you were to be a poker player and you had to prep for a 12-hour session, how would you do that? You know, to like, you know, have the optimum amount of energy and focus.
I think the first thing would be to be physically fit as you can be on the other days, or certainly say as physically fit as you can be. Obviously, not necessarily athlete level, but certainly be going to the gym very frequently, making sure that there's you actually have stamina there. Obviously, I do my MP3s, so I'd use an MP3 or I'd meditate before the session. Make sure that your nutrition's correct. Make sure that you have plenty of water for the session. Make sure that you're actually going to make the most of each of the breaks.
What I do about nutrition, because I get a 5-minute break and I barely get a chance to pee. You know, I'm like, so how do I eat good when I have to play for 12 hours straight and I get no breaks?
I mean, really, ideally, you would have pre-prepared meals in the fridge that you run to and grab and snack at. I mean, it's not ideal, the whole idea of playing for 12 hours straight. I mean, it's not the most natural activity in the world. So it's sort of just doing the best that you can. So, you know, perhaps sort of the whole classic nuts, fruits, and seeds as you're eating, green smoothies prepared, et cetera, but, you know, the reality is you're playing a competitive game for 12 hours. It's not going to be easy to have everything as optimal as you'd like if you were playing two-hour sessions then with a half-an-hour break.
Yeah, what really sorry to cut you off. What really helps me is to have a lot of protein in the fridge, you know, like chicken breast and all these things that you can just go to the kitchen during the 5 minutes and just grab a little bit. Just have that ready and like over the sessions. And I don't, for example, I don't take any caffeine in any way, you know, no tea, no Coca-Cola or anything like that at the beginning or before the session, because you will burn out very fast. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but like if you start drinking it at the beginning, I've seen a lot of people after like 4 or 5 hours getting really tired because the caffeine in their body all of a sudden starts to go away. And so if I take any tea, like green tea or something like that, I just do it at the end of the session, you know, like after 6-7 hours where I see, okay, I got a deep table or two. Then I start telling my girlfriend, can you please get me some green tea and have like another cup ready? So
give my coffee, woman.
Sorry? What did you say?
You yell out like, give my coffee.
Yeah, I mean, why not? No, but I think, you know,
I mean, that makes sense. You're not burning yourself out again in the early game, and you know, obviously the worst case scenario there is you have loads of coffee at the beginning, and that means you have to have even more coffee later on.
Absolutely.
And you end up really jittery and not being able to think straight, because then you've got the mixture of being tired and overstimulated at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a very cool thing that you said, like, go to the gym frequently. Is there, like, anything that you would suggest, you know, like, I don't know, like, 2 times a week where for an hour? Is there anything that people can, like, especially poker players?
I mean, certainly, there's definitely a connection between the highest stakes players I work with, typically, and the amount of exercise and the sort of balanced life that they live. So a lot of those guys are going to the gym frequently, maybe not daily, but multiple times a week. A lot of those guys are also doing yoga or meditation. Like, there's definitely a correlation between people reaching the very top of the game and people having those sorts of things in their lives. You know, in terms of exercise, I think it's good that the individual does something that suits them. You know, some people want to do weights, some people, I mean, I would probably say you're looking to become sort of physically fit, but you're not looking to become an athlete. There's no point in burning yourself out every day. You know, your sport is poker, but the sort of the running or the yoga, etc., is helping to improve the poker. But I don't think there's a need to be, you know, absolutely burning yourself out. But it should be, as I say, the best guys are doing multiple times a week at the gym, yoga, meditation, and it's really, really common theme throughout a lot of them.
And what you said about going to the gym during the week, basically, so you would not recommend going to the gym on a Sunday, right? Like, if you play on a Sunday, you would not recommend?
I mean, the sort of thing where I would say go for a walk.
Okay, yeah. Or yoga or something, right?
Yeah, just like low impact on a Sunday. Get the blood flowing, you know, perhaps go on an exercise bike. Or not. Get things moving, the blood flowing, do some yoga. Don't go in and absolutely destroy yourself with a weight session and then sit down for your Sunday session. You know, it's just logic. You know, this isn't.
I think a lot of the problems people have with working out is like they'll start out and then they'll really fucking push themselves and just feel like, you know, complete shit the next day and, you know, it'll be really painful during it as well. Like, you know, they really try and feel that burn and, you know, push themselves. And I was listening to this guy on the Tim Ferriss podcast, Pavel, his name's really long, really hard to pronounce, so not even going to try. But he trains bodybuilders, and he researches who were the most, who were the best, rather, best bodybuilders, you know. And he found out, like, it was the guys from the 80s, and he emulated that strategy. And they never did more than one-third to two-thirds of their max reps on any set, ever. And when they're strength training, they just avoid the burn. And I guess there's, like, some science behind
it
that.
It keeps people coming back. like as exactly as you said, you know, a poker player isn't looking to get sort of become an athlete. You're looking to just get physically fitter and get your blood flowing and just have an increase in stamina. So, you know, you're better off just consistently going to the gym rather than killing yourself at the gym and then ruining some poker sessions.
Yeah, a lot of people look at it like, oh, how can I be effective? What's the best workout? And they don't.
Consistency.
They don't try and be consistent. They don't try and enjoy it. It's just like they just try and do it. And humans, I think we just really suck at doing things we don't enjoy. It's hard enough to do the things you enjoy in life. Like, you know, I have two kids, wife. It's just there's so many things I want to do, and I just don't get to do them on a week in, week out basis, let alone go kill myself at the
gym. Something that you dread.
Like, yeah, so like figuring out how to make it an enjoyable practice, figuring out how to make anything you do, you know, especially your poker, an enjoyable practice, something you enjoy doing, I think is really important.
Yeah, I mean, you could also play basketball or, you know, like three times a week instead of going to the gym if you really, you know, if you really focused while you play basketball. You could also, you know, like, you don't need to lift weights, but you could work out your triceps, your biceps, and all these things right before you play basketball. And you could, like, really get into a really good state by doing that.
Well, again, it's just getting your blood flowing.
Exactly.
You know, that would be absolutely fine, because you're increasing your stamina, you're getting things moving, and just sort of refreshing your body with it. Again, it's just a case of just not wanting to absolutely wreck yourself for your then week's work.
Is this also something that you help people out with in your sessions? You know, like when they, for example, are not, you know, you ask this question and they're like, no, I don't work out. Is it something where you
it's something that I definitely comment on. You know, I will let everyone know that this is what the best players are doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is if that's what the best players are doing and you're choosing not to do it, then that's one of the sort of the excuses that you can't give. You're not doing everything you can if you're not emulating what the best people in your industry are doing. You know, if the guys who are winning are meditating, doing yoga, going to the gym, and you're not, then you've really got to question why you're not doing that. If you've seen that the results, it's having positive results on people you're competing with.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very important thing what you just said, that this is something that the best players are doing. And I think this is something where a lot of people struggle with, where they think, you know what, I want to be myself. You know, I don't want to copy anyone. I don't want to be the next, I don't know, Phil Ivey. I want to be me. And what would you say are like the most important things that people should copy from the best players in the world?
Work ethic is probably the most important thing, and life balance.
Work ethic and life balance, okay.
Yeah, certainly for poker. If you're not studying, you don't deserve to win.
Okay.
And then if you're getting to that higher level, and as I say, if you're getting to a high level and wondering why you're tired after 11 hours and your opponents aren't, and you're not going to the gym, that's why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because, as I say, it's the life balance needs to be there as well. As well as with the exercise and stamina that you get from the gym, you get to feel good about yourself for something other than poker.
Sorry.
I was just going to quickly say there are some successful players who are absolutely obsessed with poker and that's all they do. But the vast majority of successful players actually have decent life balance there as well. So they, you know, they do go out with their friends, they do exercise, they do things like yoga. So they have a bad day at the tables And that's not, that doesn't mean that they've failed completely that day, because, you know, they've also been for their run. They've also organized to meet up with some friends later in the week. It's very hard if all you have in your life is poker and absolutely nothing else, because basically if poker goes wrong, which we all know everyone has downswings, those downswings hurt an awful lot more.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, how do you find the life balance? How do you structure your days? Do you have specific ways?
I talk to players about organizing schedules, and typically we choose hours that are best for them in the games that they're playing, hours where they know that they're most focused, and sort of numbers of hours with breaks in place if they're cash game players or, you know, sit and go players. Obviously, as I say, it's different for MTTs.
How do you structure it? What do you do for life balance? How do you manage all this craziness that's going on?
Oh, sorry, with me? Personally, or Pedro, or?
You personally, yeah.
Oh, me personally, I just have the hour. I have in place the hours that I work for my hypnotherapy. I actually work 7 days a week, most weeks, because I'm working with people in different time zones. But the reason I work typically 5 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then basically I'm not competing with anyone. So, you know, if I was trying to do a 12-hour, if I had to do 12-hour days, I would be planning days off.
Yeah, this is actually one of the questions that I was thinking about before we talked. You know, it was like, what does keep you motivated? You know, what keeps Elliot Rowe motivated to do
this for 10 years?
Yeah.
I absolutely love my job. I absolutely, in terms of, and this is one of the reasons I don't take a lot of time off, is because I would rather be working with people. I see an enormous amount of change in people when I work with them. And that means I get an awful lot of job satisfaction. I've seen people go from basically losing money to becoming very, very wealthy relatively quickly. You know, I've seen people who won't leave the house, get girlfriends, and move forward with their lives. People with, you know, phobias of flying, then get on planes and travel. And then obviously people who weren't UFC champions become UFC champions, things like that. I get an awful lot of satisfaction from my job. So I can't see that I'll ever stop doing this. I say to people, if I won the lottery, I'd do my job for free. And I genuinely 100% believe that. If I came into a huge amount of money, I wouldn't do as many hours a week, but I would still be doing this for free.
Okay, so I hope for you that you win the lottery.
Yeah,
because
then
I would get all this for free.
You'll save some cash.
That would be awesome. I'm going to pray today.
Yeah, well, I tell you, if I win the lottery, I'll be happy that you prayed. But, you know, it's one of those things. That's why I'm motivated. It's because when you see results, it's very easy to enjoy your job.
Yeah.
I'm talking to very interesting people as well.
That's the big problem with playing poker. It's this very like selfish game, you know what I mean? So you're talking about like these people you get to see and help, and it just feels so much better than, you know, helping yourself or winning a tournament, you know what I mean? What can like a poker player do to kind of like get out of like the selfish habit, you know, because it's inherently very selfish game, you know what I mean? You're just trying to take other people's money.
I think when you get to the higher level, you do exactly what you guys are doing right now.
Yeah.
You share with people who want to learn how to improve. You stake people, you coach people, you help people improve their lives. You do positive things in other parts of your life. You know, as I say, it's sort of like a growth within the industry. As people move up, you know, sort of pay it back. You know, people have helped you through the years, then you help the next people along the line who want to put the effort in and want to reach these higher stages. And then I guess it wouldn't feel quite such a selfish enterprise.
I actually have something very actual about this topic. A friend of mine was in Egypt. I think he arrived like 2 or 3 days ago, back home, and he went on something that had nothing to do with poker, but rather, you know, like a future coaching, financial coaching. You know, what do you do with your life? How do you set up your life to be very successful? And he's a cash game player, and he basically said that he was there, and all this like all this stuff was about was actually helping other people as much as you can. And and he's a poker player, and he loves poker, and he wants to stay a poker player. And he said that actually because of this seminar that he had, we only talked like for like 10 or 15 minutes about it, but it was very interesting. And all this seminar was about was basically just, you know, just get happy and help as many people as you can on the way and make other people happier. And I think this has to do with everything, whatever you do in life. If you help other people, it makes you happy back, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
As I say, I'm very fortunate that I genuinely believe that I'm helping people, and that makes it very easy to go to turn my computer on in the morning.
this is a tough business. Whatever you do, as long as you are your own boss, basically, whatever you do, you go through really tough times. I mean, I watch a lot of what is this guy, Elon Musk? Yeah, I always forget about his name, but he says that when you start a business, whatever business it is, it could also be poker, at the beginning you're extremely happy and you're like, oh my god, this new thing, and you're pumped up and you want to play. And then at some point you reach like a downswing, like in poker, a downswing, and you're like, oh my god, this sucks. My life is so bad. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do something else. And I think one of the things that Daryl and me had was we had all these ideas, all these business models, that, like things that we wanted to do. And some things we started, but then we just stopped them after a few days, or we didn't even start. We talked about it.
Story of my life.
Yeah. And I think that you are actually the number one person for me, Elliot, who got things in perspective. And you not that you said, you know, Pedro, do this and this and this, but it was more like the talks that we had was also about getting a consistency in my life. And I think this is something that a lot of people can benefit a lot. If I would have to say what is the number one thing that people can benefit from Elliot Rowe, because this is how I experienced it, it's more like this consistency that I gained because of you and understanding how do you say it, like how I sabotage myself, right? This is something that you talk about a lot.
Yeah, so everyone's got these things in the background that it might be fear of failure, or it might even be fear of success, and we'll sabotage ourselves and we'll stop doing. A lot of people will be getting close to the top in something, and then suddenly they'll hate it, or they'll be bored of it. Or, you know, in poker, we'll see people, you know, someone's doing really well, they've doubled their bankroll, so they decide to go play the highest stakes heads up. Okay, well, what's the individual doing there? Do they really think they're going to win? Or are they uncomfortable with their new bigger bankroll and they're just trying to go back to normal?
Yeah.
You know, and it's removing that self-sabotage so you can allow yourself to be successful. You can allow yourself to start a business and then instead of just quitting after a few days, actually see it through and allow yourself to have the risk of failure and say, well, if it fails, that's absolutely fine, I've tried, rather than say, you know, if I don't try, I can't fail. You've got to see it as, you know, if I don't try, I have failed. And it's sort of a change, this small change in that mindset that, you know, people start actually doing things and moving their life forward rather than being stuck where they are. And, you know, if you look in life, the vast majority of people are sort of stuck where they are and uncomfortable moving outside of that. And it's a small percentage of people who manage to move out of the self-sabotage and the fear of being judged and then go out on a limb and try and make something work. And not everything will, but the key thing is then learning from that and trying the next thing and the next thing and the next thing until you find something that you really love and works for you.
Yeah, man, those are great words. Absolutely. I think a lot of people have a ton of good ideas and good intentions, but then they encounter that wall, you know what I mean? And then they're like, oh no, I can't do this because of this and that, whatever it is.
The excuses are so easy. It's always easy to find an excuse for anything.
Yeah.
As to why you shouldn't do it, you really need to find excuses as to why you should.
Oh, yeah.
In all of those situations. And it really is sort of a life philosophy change, though, that you just have to accept that the risk of trying and failing is much, much lower than the risk of not fail, of not trying at all.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say that comes up more than anything else. When, you know, we do a lot of sort of techniques within the hypnotherapy where we're, this person's asking their subconscious why they're not doing what they know they should do. And it comes up more than anything else. If I don't try, I can't fail.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's the biggest thing by far that people are saying, you know, well, you know, if I try my hardest, if I do study, you know, the hours I should study, if I do go to the gym, if I do put in the hours at the table, if I do all of that and I fail, I'm not as good as I thought I was. If I tell everyone I don't study and I don't go to the gym, but I'm still doing okay at poker, then they can keep in their mind that if I did those things, then I'd probably be awesome.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and they would rather not test it.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the... I was listening to Tony Robbins' audiobook, and he was talking about how all people's decisions are come down to basically pain versus pleasure, basically. Are you familiar with that at all?
I had someone discuss it with me, actually. I'm not familiar with that one of his book, that book. But I have heard that you know, you're always going to make that decision between the two, and you have to sort of increase the way you view the pleasure in order to change your decision making.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Like, he really kind of boiled down like all decisions. So like you said, people will think about, like, the pain of, like, doing something and failing, or the pain of how hard something's going to be, and they don't compare it to, like, the pain of, like, not doing something, you know, the regret I'm going to feel, how terrible I'm going to feel afterwards, or anything like that. It's pretty interesting. I haven't got through the whole book, so I was curious if you had any other, like, thoughts on it, or if it's just, like, the same thing.
Well, one of the things is future pacing. So... we sort of do this within sessions, but it's something that you can do yourself, is you think about something that you're planning to do, and then think about, you know, do you wish you'd done this 5 years ago? And everyone's always saying, yeah, I wish I'd started going to the gym 5 years ago. And then think, okay, thinking forward 5 years, 10 years from now, how will you feel about wishing you'd started today? And it's that idea that, you know, at one stage in the future, you're going to be looking back at this moment, the decision you make to either go to the gym consistently or the decision you make to start that business. And just as you feel now you wish you'd started it 5 years ago, then you'll be thinking about the same now. And you have to sort of see that nothing's going to change if you don't start these things. You have to break out of that program of just allowing things to just be and accept that if you want to feel better in the future, you have to make the change now.
Yeah, this is kind of a question for Pedro, because I feel like you're one of the few people who just feel like, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like you have much fear for failure. Like, you really don't care, like, about starting a new business, putting yourself out there, like, whatever you do. Like, how did you get to that point? Were you always that way, or?
I'm scared as hell. I'm scared. No, I'm serious. I'm scared all the time. One thing that I do on Sundays... that really keeps me going and really helps me is I watch videos from, like, I take 1 hour off. Like, for example, I just spend my day doing yoga, meditate, walk around my family, take time out with my brother. Actually, this is something that I have because of Elliot. I had huge problems with dealing with some issues, and he really helped me on that. So I spent my Sundays basically very similar. And one thing that I do 1 hour before I play, I listen to videos on YouTube from Elon Musk, from Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, you know, things that they said, interviews, some like motivational videos that I really like. And I watch them over and over and over again. And one thing that happens in my, well, I guess like that cultivates in my brain was that these guys are scared, you know, these guys are scared every single time they do something. But they don't allow that being scared stops them. And so I just thought, man, I have some things where I can help someone. You know, I'm not the smartest person in the world. I'm not like the most experienced person in the world. But there are things where I can help people with. And if I don't do it, this is something that Elliot already explained. Like, if I don't do it, you know, like, it's going to get lost, basically. And so why not just try to do it and see how it goes? And for example, one of the most important things is just tell everybody what you're doing. I don't know, what is this name of, you know, when you see like a guy who works for a company and he hands you over like this plastic thing with his number and stuff. What was that called in English?
A business card?
Yeah, exactly, like a business card. And what I did, I have a business card now from our website, and all there is on there is the website, basically, and on the back of it is I wrote, "You deserve more." That's the only thing that's on there. Because I thought, I don't need a number, I don't need to explain anything, I just need to write, when I give that person my business card, I just need to write down what I think in that situation. So I started to hand over people that stuff, and that way I forced myself to do this. You know, there's no option, because I already told everybody, Pedro Gonçalves is doing Change the Why. And if you don't do it, and then everybody's going to be like, well, you gave me your business card, and now you're not doing it, so how does that work? You know, so I just forced myself. It doesn't matter if I want it or not, because in the end, as long as I know that I'm really trying to help people, I think I'm just doing the right thing. And if I'm scared or not, it doesn't matter in the end.
Yeah, is it the same in UFC? Are people like, you know, is people who step into the ring, aren't they just scared too, but kind of just like fight through that or just sit with that or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of varies. I mean, I work with a lot of people looking to overcome that. So, you know, through sessions, we'll go from people being, you know, incredibly anxious, as I explained, struggling to sleep the week of the fight, to I try and make them feel grateful for the fight so they're excited when they get there. Because it's a change in mindset from, oh my goodness, what if I make a mistake, to I'm so lucky, I've been training for 20 years and I get to show the world what I can do. I'm really grateful for this, and I'm grateful that I have an opponent who's there to test me so that I can test my skills that I've been training for the last 20 years.
Wow, that's a huge start.
So, you know, so that changes the whole dynamic. Instead of feeling, I'm scared of my opponent, they're going to help me, you feel grateful that they've trained as hard as you have and that you can compete against them, and you get a chance to show everyone, you know, how hard you guys have worked at martial arts. So it's like reframing it for them. So that, yeah, a lot of guys do start off really scared, really upset, all of these things. But certainly the work I do is trying to move them far away from that and just be free to basically fight without tension and restriction in their body. Basically, if you're really tense and really scared and you try to throw a punch, your shoulders are going to be, you're not going to have the mobility. Whereas if you're relaxed and just in the zone and the flow of everything, everything's much faster, and that typically creates better performances.
I was listening to Joe Rogan podcast. He's a big UFC guy. He was actually saying, like, too little fear is actually like a bad thing. If like you're just completely relaxed and not worried at all, he says that's like a bad thing.
I would disagree with him. If you look at hopefully one day I'll be talking to Joe about this. but basically, if you the most successful fighters there have ever been in mixed martial arts is a Russian called Fedor Emelianenko. And then Anderson Silva, who until recently was dominating, and they were absolutely relaxed, walking into the cage, absolutely relaxed in the way that they moved. They weren't trying to force anything. I mean, you've got to be focused and aware. So yeah, I mean, in terms of if he's saying that you have
to
be...
Yeah, that's what he meant. Like, you're not going to be focused. Okay. You're just like, I got this. You know what I mean?
Sorry. There's a difference between being overly confident, which may be what he meant by no fear, because if someone's excessively confident and they think the person can't help hurt them, then yeah, that's a problem. But having a respect for your opponent and going there to demonstrate what you can do, but being intensely focused and focused on what it is you're supposed to be doing in that cage, is a positive mindset. But going in there with tension in your muscles and at a fear, isn't going to be a productive way of fighting.
Okay, so is the goal twofold, or is it just one way? Is the goal just to eliminate fear completely, or to be able to have that fear and still do what you have to do, whether in fighting or anything?
It's to eliminate irrational fear. So you need a healthy respect for... So in poker or in fighting, you need to have a healthy respect for what your opponents can do. So you shouldn't be sitting at the table thinking, I can absolutely crush everyone's rubbish, because that would be ridiculous. Yeah. It's exactly the same sort of healthy fear I'm describing in fighting. You're going in there knowing the other person is a professional and you have to be cautious, but that you don't go in with a fear of, oh my god, everyone's so much better than me, I don't know what to do, I'm feeling frozen. If you freeze in a fight or you freeze in decisions in poker, you're going to lose. So it's having that freedom of being able to basically think clearly in the moments under pressure while still appreciating this is competitive. It's not, you're not going to absolutely crush everybody. People will, you'll still lose some fights. You'll still lose some poker games. But you shouldn't be losing them because you're frozen, stuck still.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Does that make sense in terms of the different... It's sort of, I guess, a different thought of what fear is. And there is healthy fear, but, you know, you shouldn't be throwing up backstage. You shouldn't be shaking when you walk into the cage. You know, that's the sort of the adrenaline response. There should be adrenaline, but you should feel... There's adrenaline with excitement as well as adrenaline with fear. It's preferable to have an excitement rather than...
I think you were talking about, Pedro, like... You know how fear of, fear of something like really bad happening to you, mm-hmm. like how that can drive you towards success. You know, like reaching like that really bad point and just being like, oh, I don't ever want to go back there again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is what I talk with Elliot a lot about. Yeah, I have this. I asked him like, there's so many different, how do you say, like forces in your life that can guide you to become different, and I think the first time I heard about this was a story about a very successful lawyer in New York City, I think. And basically they interviewed him and they asked him like how he became like this. And he said, well, I had a very bad childhood, you know, like everything was terrible. My father beat my mother all the time. He was drunk all the time. How could I not become successful when I was in a very bad childhood. I don't want to be there again. And then they found out he had a brother, and his brother actually was in prison. And he had, like, basically the worst record you could ever have. And he explained the same story, and then he said, you know, how could I not become drug addicted, being raised in that home? And it's just, like, the same story, but it drives into two completely different directions.
This is an excellent example of the work I do in terms of reframing situations for people in their memories.
Yeah.
So both of them are talking about the same situation. One of them has framed it as a negative, and one of them's framed it as a way to move their life forward.
Yeah.
So in the sort of work that I do in terms of memories of childhood, abusive parents, you know, assaults, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're always looking to frame things into the positive moving life forward rather than the dwelling on it and allowing it to be an excuse to let your life go.
Yeah, and I mean...
There's the results of it. You know, these people have had the same starting point, and the difference in mindset is the difference between the two brothers.
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts on, like, positivity versus negativity? Are you, like, all the way to the extreme? Are you, like, choice center, you know, where it's, like, everything you do has to be positive, or... What are the benefits, you think, in negativity, or is there any benefits, or, you know, what are your thoughts there?
I don't think there's any value in framing anything in your life in a negative way. I don't think there's any value in holding negativity towards basically, you know, people who've done things bad to you in the past, holding on to fear, those sorts of things. So from looking back as a reference point from the present to what's happened in your life, you need to see that everything's taken you to where you are today and that there's no point in holding on to the negative from any of that. I don't believe that just believing you're going to win money means you'll win money. So do you see where I'm coming from? So, yeah. So I sort of see it as more, you want to be framing all of your past in a positive light. There's no point in holding any tension from that. It will be negative to you if you hold on to that negativity. But then it's not purely, I don't purely believe. I believe it to some extent in positive thinking. I do think you're more likely to work harder if you believe the goal is achievable and that it's worth having an optimistic mindset, because you're, you know, if you start a business and you think this is definitely going to fail, you're not going to work very hard. If you start a business with this could make me rich, you're going to work much harder. Or this is going to make me rich, you're going to work very hard at it. And I think that's where positive thinking is really creating these changes. Like if someone goes into things with that optimistic mindset, they're more likely to be successful. But I don't believe that purely just believing that something, telling yourself you're going to win lots of money will mean that you'll win lots of money because you've asked the universe for it. I don't see it in that sort of sense.
Secret that, isn't one of your favorite books.
And I'll be honest, I think it can be good for people to read The Secret. And I mean, sometimes when people are really down, I'll sort of say, you know, try reading The Secret, see what you think. But I don't necessarily think it's particularly magical in how that it works. I think if someone is more positive, they're more likely to work harder. So does that make sense? So I sort of see The Secret can be a tool to read, even if it's not necessarily accurate in the... So as a metaphor, if you're positive, optimistic, and you work hard, you're more likely to be successful than someone who's depressed and refusing to do anything. So it can be useful from that sense, but I don't necessarily believe it in the, you know, it's going to guarantee you success purely by putting yourself in that mindset.
Yeah, I guess, like, I was thinking there's some benefits to negativity, like understanding, like, that bad things can actually happen and then kind of, like, preparing for them, you know, just in case, you know, instead of just being like, oh, I'm going to do this and it's going to work out good, you know, I'm going to be 100%, like, optimist here. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of, like, the caution I was talking about, sitting at a certain poker table with people who are better than you or getting into a cage fight with another professional. You have to be aware of risks, but certainly in terms of, you know, the positive person is more likely to move forward with, yeah, it's sort of an awareness of risk, I guess, is the key point from my side.
Have you ever told someone to, I mean, doesn't matter if it's UFC fighter, golfer, or poker player, that this, what he's doing is nothing for him? Did you ever get to that point?
Yeah, I have.
What was, like, the thing that really made you do that? Was it, like, working for, like, a few months with him and it just didn't click, or was it pain?
Working with somebody for quite a while and seeing that they're not doing the work, they're not having success, and it's affecting their life in a bad way. Poker isn't for everybody, and people can get better, and the vast majority of people can improve and can start to make money, but there are some people who should see it as something. If they want to play it for fun, that's fine, but it shouldn't be their profession. They're going to make a lot more money and be a lot happier doing other things. And it's very extreme cases. It's only happened a couple of times, but I have had to say to people, I really think you should rethink what you're doing. It's quite clear that this is affecting your life, your family life. You're not improving at a pace where that's going to change anytime soon. We have to be realistic in this situation. You know, not quit poker recreationally. Eventually it might be something that you can play more of, but I like to say that, you know, I try and be as absolutely honest with people as I can, and I don't obviously want to crush anyone's dreams, but there are times when you have to say things to people that they don't want to hear, and they can choose to take my advice or not, but I'm not going to pretend to somebody that, you know, everything's absolutely fine if they're not improving and they're harming themselves or their family by doing it.
Man.
You know, so it's just, you know, I wondered, have you had the similar sort of thing? Have you ever had any students who...
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Who've had that conversation with?
Absolutely. I had that with mostly with people that were over-aggressive, and they just think that they can just bully everybody and just be the man, and you keep working with them and explaining, and they just cannot, because they have some kind of issue in their back of their head where they think, you know, I have to bully all these guys. I'm better than these guys. And you cannot get them to balance somehow, you know, you cannot get them tighter. Mostly those were the cases in my experience where I couldn't, like, I just told them, you know, this is nothing for you. You're losing money over the long run just because you cannot view this game as what it is. You know, you're viewing this game as something personal. And that's where I was like, okay, sorry, this is really nothing for you. I don't know if Daryl had the same experience, but this is how it was for me.
No, I haven't told anyone that yet, basically. I've definitely had, like, a guy who was, like, really over aggro, but it took, like, 6 months of, like, just going through hand histories and just showing them, oh, this is a really bad play, or, like, well, this is a really bad play, well, this is a really bad play, and then, like, I think eventually he got it.
Nice. Like... That's actually a positive outcome. I didn't have that. I mean, really, like, either it was within the first 4 weeks that they understood, okay, I'm too aggressive, or I'm too tight, and then they changed it. But when it lasted longer than, like, a month, I continued working with them and tried it, but it usually didn't work out. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the difference was this guy was, like, pretty, he's pretty, like, good analytical thinker. So we kind of just, like, framed it in, like, a different way. You know, what's the best way I can do this? Like, what's the, you know, if I'm going to take this kind of, like, crazy line, what's some of the best hands I could do this with?
Yeah. Makes sense. Okay, cool. Guys, I would like to thank you, Elliot, for all your time, and I would like to ask you, like, just a few short questions, and you answer them, like, as quickly as possible. Daryl, do you have any questions we didn't ask, by the way? Anything?
Yeah.
Okay, just shoot, and we'll, like, make it, like, really short.
Oh, sorry, I'll try and blast through them.
Exactly.
Yeah, just a quick, like, Tim Ferriss-type questions that I like. Nice. You know, what is... like, when you think of someone successful, who do you think of? First person comes to your head. Like, most successful.
Ironically, Tim Ferriss is one of them.
Nice.
Yeah.
Because he's living the lifestyle I want to lead, you know, in terms of the helping people, the books. So ironic, but true.
Nice.
What's your morning routine like?
Getting out of bed, organizing my breakfast, getting up my twins. At the moment, my routine is based around my children. So it's feeding my baby twins, getting them dressed, getting them changed, getting showered, dressed and ready, and then just setting myself up. I like to take a few minutes before I start my day to sort of clear my head and get going, sort of the split between a 5 minute split between the dealing with 6-month-old twins and then the starting to talk to clients. But it's sometimes I manage to get to the gym in the morning, but a lot of it depends on how much crying and things is going on and if I'm able to leave them with my wife or not.
All right, last question. Favorite one or two, whatever.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. It cut out.
What are your favorite books?
My favorite books, in terms of self-help type, I mean, 1984 is my favorite novel. And then try and think in terms of the other. So I recently bought, The Art of Learning, which is...
Excellent book, man. Excellent.
I really, really like that book. I think, although it's about chess, I think that's the best poker book on the market. I really say anyone out there who plays should read The Art of Learning. It's just excellent.
Yeah. Cool. My question that I always like to ask in the end, if you could go back in time 10 years and you would have one sentence to tell yourself, what would that be? Like some kind of thing that you wish you had done, some kind of advice, anything.
Lottery numbers.
Yeah, well, I'd probably just say, don't worry about anything. It will be great.
Like, yeah, I like that.
You know, just let yourself know. Like, I'm very fortunate. I really, really enjoy my job. And, you know, I've done jobs in the past I didn't particularly enjoy. I've had stressful times. And, you know, I think I would say, you know, it's all good. It all works out in the end.
Nice.
Yes, I think there's this Mark Twain quote where he says, I suffered a great many tragedies, most of which never happened.
Yeah, and that's accurate for 99% of people, I think. If we're honest with that, you know, if we find the right thing, then the things we worry about, just a lot of the time, they just don't seem to actually occur.
Yeah, awesome. I really like this. I mean, I highly enjoy talking to you every single time. And it was really a blast for me, so thanks for your time. I will...
that's not for having me on.
I will share also your site that you gave me, right? I'll put it under the notes.
Perfect.
And
Where can I find you?
Exactly.
Twitter. Oh, yes. PokerMindCoach.com is my website. And then on Twitter, I'm at ElliotRowe1. And on Facebook, if you search Elliot Rowe, I come up as well. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all the places you'll be able to find me.
Awesome. Yeah, if anyone has troubles finding Elliot, we will put it on our sites under the podcast so you can find him. So yeah, thanks again for this time, Daryl. Enjoy your day. And talk to you later. Thanks to you. Bye.
Cheers, guys. Thank you both so much. Cheers. Bye.